Caller number 10 at 800-636-1067. Congrats. You're going to win two tickets to see The Offspring Supercharged Worldwide this summer, Saturday, July 19th, Jiffy Lube Live. Special guest Jimmy Eat World, Newfound Glory. Tickets are on sale now. For tickets and more event information, go to thefandc.com/events. Jordan Ta'amu, who was on the Chiefs, was on the Commanders, a couple of other NFL teams, is the starting quarterback of the D.C. Defenders, who are playoff-bound, going to be in studio with us coming up at 5 o'clock. And the GM of the Capitals, Chris Patrick, is on the show today at 5:30. But it is time right now for our Beltway Blitz. And to get things started on the Nats, we talked to our buddy Craig Heist, who was on the beat during the Nats O's weekend series, and the Nats put the beat down on the Birds. Heisty, Brandon Hyde got fired. The Nats scored 24 runs. Man, are the Orioles struggling right now.
Yeah, they really are, Grant, and they didn't get any better last night because they got a Cedric Mullins home run, three-run homer to get the game tied up at four. And then Yennier Cano gave it up in the bottom of the eighth inning. And it was a 5-4 loss, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Cano now, especially with Alvarado being out in Philadelphia. Who knows? They could work a trade somehow or another to get Cano up there.
I see. Let's go to the Nats at this stage. It's basically Abrams and Wood and pray for rain when it comes to the offense over here of late, but that's been kind of good enough. What are you seeing from those guys?
Well, Abrams obviously is attack first pitch, Danny. And the fastball preferably, and he's done a lot of damage with that in terms of the home runs here recently. He had two in the Orioles series, and he's just making things happen. He's getting his base hits, too. That's the other thing. And making an impact on the bases and playing that defense that he's become known for. And you won't see a prettier double play that ended that game yesterday. With Abrams and Saturday, I guess it was, with Abrams and Luis Garcia. I really think that the day he hit the two home runs, he was more excited about the double play than he was the home runs. But, you know, James Wood just continues to impress, hits the ball the opposite way, hit the ball to right center field for one of the home runs over the weekend. He's just been very good and keeps getting better.
Wood on pace for 40 home runs and 100 runs batted in at 22. By the way, looking back at that Soto deal right now, C.J. Abrams on his way to a second straight All-Star team at 24 years old. Mackenzie Gore is leading all of Major League pitchers in strikeouts on the mound. Wood on pace for a 4,100 season at 22, and two of their best prospects who are closing in on being big league ready in Robert Hassel's case. Not too shabby, huh?
Not too shabby, and I'll tell you what, you won't see a weirder game than you saw in the first game of this series back on Friday night, because Mackenzie Gore didn't get very deep in the game, only 3 2/3, but the line for him in that game, it was nuts. You looked at it and it was 3 2/3, 10 hits, he struck out 9, and only allowed 2 runs. I mean, who does that? It was crazy.
Yeah, that was the first line like that in history. I mean, it never happened before.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. It really was. But you know what? The bottom line was he did what Davey Martinez always preaches. You know, obviously he had the high pitch count. That was one thing. We don't like to see that. But he gave up only the 2. He kept them in the ball game, gave the offense a chance to do things. And in that series, guys, the offense had 2 6-run innings, first inning one night and the second inning the next night.
Heisty, the numbers haven't been great, but I feel like Mike Soroka's throwing the ball okay. I didn't know how this experiment was going to go. Again, the numbers don't look very good. People are going to hear this and go, you're talking about a guy with a 6 ERA, throwing the ball yeah. well? What's the matter with you? But kind of going within the starts, I actually think he's been okay, and I think you'll see some stuff start to equalize here. Do you think they might have found something here with one of their bargain bin shopping sprees?
I think they may have, and he's got a track record, Danny, and who knows? He was talking to us over the weekend. After the start, which was, you know, 6 innings, they didn't score against him until late when he had to come out of the ball game. I guess it was the 6th inning. But he kept them in the game, gave him a chance to win, and I think he's throwing the ball pretty well. I think you're right.
Hi, Steve. Thank you, buddy. We appreciate you.
All right. Take care, Grant.
Nats see you, buddy. Hosting the Braves tonight. Spencer Strider on the hill against Mitchell Parker. 6:45 first pitch. 6:15 pregame. Let's talk football. Nate Davis, USA Today Sports. Nate, do you think the league will restructure how it seeds playoff teams 1 through 7? And do you think that they should?
I do think that they should, Grant. I'm totally fine with the division winner getting the automatic bid, but I think that the seeding should, or that your record should help determine your seeding. I mean, I look at the Buccaneers, who have averaged a 9-8 record the last 3 years, but they always, you know, and never in that time would they have been a top four seed because they play in a weak division. I mean, I think that's a perfect example of why, but I don't think it's going to happen now. I think it might happen closer to when we get the 18-game schedule and maybe, you know, the division component of your schedule becomes even smaller than it is now.
What about the tweaked rule here from Green Bay? It was basically, hey, let's not have the assisted quarterbacks, Nick Tush Push, brother of the shove, whatever you want to call it. Now they're reworking it basically to go back to the rule that I grew up with in football, Nate, which is you don't aid runners, period, full stop, that's the end. What do you think of that one?
Yeah, I think kind of maybe broadening it and making it theoretically easier to understand, kind of like you said, as it was 20 years ago. I can't really think of an NFL example. I kind of think back to that Reggie Bush, Matt Leinart thing. Yep. In Notre Dame. But I think that may work in favor of getting more votes. I mean, I'm not really going to be surprised how this goes either way, but it seems like momentum is moving towards eliminating the Tush Push, regardless of what the language is here.
Yeah, it seems like a semantic argument a little bit. We're not getting rid of the tush push, but you can't push anybody in the tush. You know what I'm saying? It's like, well, you're kind of getting rid of the tush push. How much disdain is there for the play around the league from what you can gather?
I don't feel like it's – I think it's kind of a player opinion to some degree. I think a lot of people feel like, you know, hey, you know, that's plays that the Eagles run. You know, we got to figure out how to stop it. I mean, and you guys know, it's always called a copycat league, and – I mean, they do a great job at it, and nobody else has really managed to copy it. So it feels to me like a bit of a vendetta against the Eagles. I remember talking to Jordan Mailata about it last year after the championship game, and, you know, he was kind of laughing about how the Eagles had beaten the Commanders from a mental warfare standpoint running that play. Talked to Landon Dickerson, their Pro Bowl guard, about it. And, you know, it's if you get away from the pushing part, which to me is kind of that Dallas Goedert and maybe a sixth offensive lineman pushing Jalen Hurts over. Obviously, that's the push component. But, otherwise, I'll tell you, really, this is us effectively running a quarterback sneak. And I think that they'll probably figure out a way to use that component of it and still use that great offensive line to get a lot of good results in short yardage plays. But it may have to be, look a little bit different.
Yeah, and that's a smart point, Nate, that I want to piggyback on. League-wide, it depends on the year, but you can have anywhere between an 80 or 90% success rate for a regular old quarterback sneak. That doesn't include a guy that can squat a million pounds, whatever it is for Jalen Hurts with the best offensive line in the sport. If they were taking away the only means to pick up a yard or a half a yard, I'd go, I get it, it's vindictive, but the quarterback sneak for everybody works great. I bet you it works even better for that specific group right there, kind of to your point.
I think so. You kind of see the way that they pack in. They kind of have that arrowhead formation, and you know they've got those two great tackles there, and great guys in the interior that know how to just people say if you can't make an yard in the NFL, then you don't deserve to be on the field or convert that fourth down, and they do it better than anybody. You know, and maybe it won't be 92%. You know, maybe it goes down to 80, but you know, I bet that will still be in their playbook in some way, shape, or form.
Is Aaron Rodgers going to play for the Steelers, and how sure are we that he's good anymore and that it matters?
I still say, Grant, he's probably a top half of the quarterback league. Even if closer to 16 than like 10.
Wow.
I think he's a better player right now than Russell Wilson is right now. That being said, I mean, my biggest contention with this thing is I don't really understand how it helps the Steelers that much. Obviously they need a quarterback. He needs a place to play. We think that this marriage will eventually happen, but you know, the Steelers for years have kind of been that 9 or 10 win team we were talking about a minute ago. They get into the playoffs, they get embarrassed in the playoffs. And then they're picking 20th in the Kenny Pickett, Paxton Lynch, Brandon Whedon zone. And like they're just kind of stuck there. So I really think that they ought to either just turn the keys over to Mason Rudolph and Will Howard or whatever. And if that works, great, go with that. But if you end up 4-13 or 5-12, you know, great. You know, you're going to be able to be in position to get a quarterback for your future. You know, I've talked to a lot of people about it, and they just haven't managed the position well since, you know, obviously since drafting Roethlisberger, have never really laid the groundwork for a replacement. But I think the biggest thing there is I just don't know that they have the stomach between the Rooneys and Mike Tomlin to, you don't want to say mail it in, but to not put the best effort forward and, you know, getting that 9 or 10 wins is important to them. But, you know, again, I think Aaron Rodgers comes, they're pretty much going to be back in the same circumstance a year from now.
Nate, super quick, I'm just seeing this come across the old news desk via Twitter. 32-0. It passed the NFL's proposal to allow players to play Olympic flag football in 2028. Your thoughts?
Not surprised. I think the NFL wants to push flag football forward. They want to push their international presence forward. This is a great way to kill two birds with one stone.
Appreciate you, buddy. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
You got it. Let's keep the blitz moving. And to talk local football with us, we got our buddy Scott Abraham of Channel 7 Sports in town. Scott, Commanders moving forward. Biggest storyline for you for the rest of the offseason is what?
How are they going to upgrade their edge position? Because I'm not really confident of the guys that they have right now on the roster that they're going to be able to get the job done. Obviously, there's plenty of veterans out there that are looking for a job. Do they somehow maybe swing a trade for Trey Hendrickson? I think that's a glaring weakness on the roster right now. Certainly, there's some guys on there that are capable, but I don't know if they're dudes. I don't know if they're studs that can routinely get to the quarterback on Sundays in the fall. So I think that's the big storyline to monitor. Can they somehow upgrade that edge position before week one?
Are we underestimating the impact of maybe how fortuitous they were last year with a more difficult schedule plus the normal potential sophomore regression of you know, I think Jaden Daniels and otherwise? Are we kind of glossing past that? Everybody seems to be talking about 12, 13 wins, et cetera.
I am cautiously optimistic, guys, that this team is not going to be a one-hit wonder, a flash in the pan. I think they have truly built an incredible culture. I just love just the feeling you get walking into that locker room, walking into that building of everybody is truly on the same page. So kudos to Adam Peters and Dan Quinn just to instill that mentality, that family, that brother. That brotherhood they always talk about. Yeah, the schedule is going to be much more challenging. A lot of primetime games, a lot of marquee games. You're moving up a weight class, but I think they're going to be better on offense. I think they're going to be dynamic. Yeah, are there concerns they may have to win 42-35 a lot of games? Yes, but I don't think the defense is going to be that poor or concerning. Right now, I think that is truly the weakness as I look on paper. But again, you've got to see how it all plays out, especially in training camp, injury-free, early part of the season. But I'm optimistic they can get double-digit wins again, and they're not going to be – they're just going to keep building. They may be, in a sense, a better team, guys, but have a worse record compared to last season. But that's because, obviously, the strength of schedule compared to last year.
Rest of the division in the NFC East, what's it look like for you?
Well, that is a great question because you know that there's been a different division winner I don't know how many years in a row now. So I'm taking the field over the Philadelphia Eagles. There's going to be a new division champion, in my opinion, because that's just how it always happens in the NFC East. I think it's going to be the Commanders, and I think it's going to be, you know, the Eagles and the Cowboys. Giants, I think, are a couple of years away, but I like what they got in Dart. I like what they're building over there, but I think they're going to be a year or two away. So I think the Cowboys might have a strong bounce back with Dak back under center. They obviously picked up George Pickens to complement CeeDee Lamb. And, of course, you're going to have the bullies up there on Route 95 in the trenches, the Philadelphia Eagles controlling the line of scrimmage. You know what they do. So Eagles, Cowboys, and the Commanders are going to be dueling all year long, and the Giants are a few steps back, in my opinion.
Scott, I've been asking a lot of folks this question. I want to get your take on it, too. Who has more offensive touches? So non-special teams version. Who has more offensive touches this year? Luke McCaffrey or rookie Jalen Lane?
Jalen Lane. I think they're really excited about this dude. Just watching the videos, hearing them talk about Jalen. They feel like they got a steal. He is versatile. He's that Swiss Army knife type player where he can make an impact in the return game. And also, don't be surprised if he finds his way into some certain packages, you know, offensively, and, you know, just get the ball in his hands. Good things seem to happen, especially what happened in Virginia Tech. How will that correlate to the NFL? That's obviously the biggest challenge for rookies, but I know they are excited and they're going to be thinking about ways to utilize Jalen Lane in 2025, guys.
Scotty, we appreciate you, buddy. Be good.
See you, fellas. Take care.
Check him out on ABC7 in town. Scott Abraham as part of our Beltway Blitz. Jordan Ta'amu, quarterback defenders at 5. Chris Patrick, GM Capitals, 525 today. Next, Juan Soto having a little regret. Perhaps we'll talk about that on The Fan. Grant and Danny on The Fan, Juan Soto, New York Met. So far, the marriage not going as seamlessly as both sides probably would have hoped. So first things first, got to acknowledge that the Mets are a good baseball team. Soto's a big part of that, by the way. The Mets had been in first place in the NL East for the majority of the season to this point. They are currently in second place. They are just a half game behind the Phillies, but they're 10 over 500. They're 29-19. They got a much better run differential than Philadelphia. They have been the best team in the National League. If not for two straight losses here, they would probably still be in first place.
Yeah, they're really good.
They're good. And Juan Soto has played fine. If you look at his numbers compared to average, he is an above-average baseball player this season. But in a game of failure, he's failing a lot, as you'd anticipate. And when you sign a contract like the one he did this offseason, heavy lies the crown. But I've been amazed, Danny, by the coverage of Juan Soto over the last couple of weeks. And Ryan was bringing some of this up and showing it to me over the last couple of days, the ways he's being talked about, written about, what fans are saying. I think this all comes back to the fact that Soto signed a 15-year deal for $765 million, a deal the likes of which we'd never seen before in Major League Baseball. $51 million per over 15 years for $765 million.
My goodness.
Shattering what Shohei Ohtani got. Now, people talk about the Ohtani contract as if it's similar, and it really isn't. Ohtani got $700 million over 10 years, $70 million per, to be a pitcher and a hitter. But so much of his money is deferred that when you look at the actual, what Scott Boras, the agent for Soto, not for Ohtani, calls like the present net value, I think he calls it, like the PNV. It's $400-some million in present-day money compared to what Soto got, which is $765 million. But if you look at some of the complaints about Soto, some of them might be fine. Some of them might be reasonable. Like, he's hitting 246. You'd like him to hit 300. He only has 8 home runs. Maybe you'd like him to have 12, like James Wood. He has an 815 OPS. His career OPS is 950. I would explain a lot of this away by saying it's May 20th. This is not how baseball works. You know this, Danny. You played collegiately at GW. Mm-hmm. You're going to go through ebbs and flows, and you can't look at snapshots a couple months into a season for the 26-year-old. But he's never been a particularly great defensive player. He struggled a little bit in the outfield. But every little thing he does is under a microscope right now. When he runs to first, he's not running hard enough. When he doesn't lay out for a ball in the outfield that falls in because it's a hit, should he have dove for it? I mean, it's literally to that extent. We had a guy, we played the audio, this has been a couple months ago now.
Yeah.
Like in the first week of the season, some goofball New York radio guy was screaming about Juan Soto taking walks and not hitting enough home runs like a handful of games into the season or something. That's what you get when you go to New York. So he went to New York, was already there with the Yankees, but via free agency, he had never chosen to go to New York, signed with New York. And he went to the Mets and he took the $765 million. So you've kind of made your bed here. But the coverage of him is insane. I mean, everything he does because of this deal is not good enough. And it just seems to me like the expectations are insane.
So, yeah, several data points that I think are instructive. Number one, his slowest or worst months historically throughout his career have been March and April. that's holding true. And it's May now, and his, you know, his business has picked up slightly, but even still, it's not quite to his career norms. I think when you sign that deal, this is what comes of it. Whether that'd be anywhere. Now, I don't know, maybe not in every baseball city. Obviously, New York is kind of its own extreme thing where they live and die with everything and they're screaming at you and the sky is falling, you know, if you roll over one ground ball. But when you're banging a ball off the wall in Boston and you pimp it and you watch it and you're jogging to first base and it hits the wall and you don't even come close to getting the second base, it's just fuel to the fire.
Absolutely.
Right? It just is.
And stuff like that is reasonable to me. Like, his manager talked to him afterwards about hustling or whatever. By the way, that happens in baseball
a lot. It does all the time.
When you get fooled, it was 105 mile an hour off the bat. He thought it was a home run. Wind's blowing in. It hits the fence. And you only get a single when you should have got a double. I get being annoyed or frustrated by that. Especially when you make $51 million. That's a tale as old as time. There are balls you're not going to catch that you should get to or whatever. There are reasonable complaints. But the vast majority of the complaints that I've seen about Juan Soto this year aren't that reasonable. It's things like I was talking with Clary the other day. And Ryan's like, I don't know, man. If I give you $700 million, I can't have you hitting 245. Like, that's not reality. That's not how baseball works. I'm sorry. You're going to hit 245 every now and then over a 7-8 week span. That's literally the game. By the way, it's league average, batting average. That just means you're league average at this point. Everyone's hitting 245. That's what people hit now against the really good pitching in Major League Baseball. But I just wonder, and this is kind of the conversation I want to have here. Mm-hmm. Could we get to a point with Soto, it's so early here, that it's clearly wearing on him a little bit. There's a couple anecdotes in a piece I was reading that Ryan sent me where he was supposed to be mic'd up for ESPN. He chose not to be.
Mm-hmm.
He was supposed to be doing like the in-game interview in the outfield. He chose not to because he doesn't want to talk about Aaron Judge. He made the comment very early in the year when he got off to the slow start, like, it's hard not having Aaron Judge behind me or something like that. And people took that as a slight to Pete Alonso, who got off to a great start. And so he got asked a million times about that. Now he's playing the Yankees for the first time, and he didn't want that to come back up. There's also a lot of Yankees fans have made this a big deal during this series. I know Michael Kay, during their telecast on the Yes Network, said, I don't know if he cited sources or suggested that this was a thing, but he basically said something along the lines of, he wishes he was still with the Yankees. He's having buyer's remorse. He's clearly just, the body language isn't good. He's not as happy with the Mets. He was having more fun with the Yankees. And so that's become this big story. He didn't want to deal with that on Sunday Night Baseball and talking about his time with the Yankees versus the Mets. So he just, despite agreeing to do it, said, no, I'm not going to do it. Got heat for that. Then, and this is not good, I will be the first one to tell you this is ridiculous, he left the media high and dry after the game, which is an obligation, especially when you make that kind of money.
Absolutely.
You sure as hell be an ambassador to the team. So he told them, hey, I'm going to go visit my family, I'll come back. And maybe he truly forgot, but he didn't come back, supposedly, didn't talk to the media. But you could just tell that dealing with the New York media, which is more of a pain in the butt than just about any other market, that are harping on every little thing more than any other market would, is already starting to get to him a little bit in his first season.
Yeah, it looks like he's not having much fun. Now, granted, that's not like I'm watching every pitch or every at bat or otherwise, but it doesn't seem like the same rip-roaring, fun-loving guy that you know played with such joy like he used to, even in other spots. Now, he's gotten off to rough starts in multiple stops. Remember, in 2019, he couldn't hit water if he fell out of a boat to start the season. With an injury mixed in there. He got off to a bad start in San Diego, got off to a tough start, I think, with the Yankees, if memory serves, but then settles in. He'll be fine. He's too good, and the process is too good. I mean, even still, while he's not hitting great, you know, still a 377 on base percentage and, you know, an OPS over 800. Like, it's not as if it's been a disaster. This is not an Anthony Rendon, you know, plays once and then sits down for 6 months, buyer's remorse kind of a deal from the team's perspective. He's been fine, but it's, when you sign, again, that deal, nobody's signing up for fine. Nobody's signing up for you with similar numbers to Tyrone Taylor. Nobody's signing up for you to be out hit in situationally by Mark Vientos, driving the big run here and there. They don't pay you $51 million in New York to ground into the leading amount of double plays. None of those things are fair, necessarily, but again, you took the deal, man. You signed up for it. So, I don't know. It's an interesting phenomenon, certainly, where I don't really have... I don't condone people going crazy like they've never seen a baseball season before in New York. I don't condone that fandom or that kind of extremist shouting media type stuff. I also have no sympathy for Juan Soto. For you could have signed anywhere, and you signed in New York with the New York media and the microscope, even after you got to experience it when you were traded. You were traded there, and you saw what it was like being in New York, and you were like, I'll sign a 15-year deal for $1 trillion to stay there, you are opening yourself up to these kinds of things. So if you've got buyer's remorse, tough. Also, I guess, you know what I mean? I don't really have any sympathy for anybody when it comes to this.
Yeah, I guess I'm not looking for sympathy, or I don't think there should be any empathy for Juan Soto, because I think what you're saying is just correct and obvious, right? When you make the choice to take all of the money and chase the bag, this is what you're bringing on. I actually tweeted about this, and I'll read you the tweet. I just want to get your thoughts on this. I said, the discourse around Juan Soto right now in New York is absolutely insane to me. Everything he does gets scrutinized, which is the point I'm making. In a game where you fail 7 out of 10 times, every failure is being held against him. I guess that's kind of my frustration. Baseball is a game where the really good ones, 3 times out of 10, do a good job. So if you just want to jump on someone constantly, you're going to get a chance to do it 70% of the time. And boy, are they enjoying doing that. Everything he's doing is under a microscope. Is he hustling? What does his body language mean? Should he have laid out for this ball? Like, that is exhausting, and it's just no good way to go about operating if you're Juan Soto. My point is, some of it's the New York media, and I cite that loud radio guy screaming about him walking too much, which is a good thing, by the way. Big part of it is the contract he signed. I think, coming back to your point, that's the name of the game here. Places a target on your back. Expectations are impossible to meet. I don't think he did anything wrong. He's hopping around, following the bag. It's America. It's capitalism. The market dictates what you're worth. I'm in on all of that stuff. But what I'm wondering is, and the reason I bring it up, could this in any way change how players view hopping around in the future?
Interesting.
To me, if I'm Juan Soto, I'm wondering right now, like, staying in New York for $750 or whatever the number was instead of $765 with the Yankees, would I be better off right now? Probably. Would I have rather stayed in Washington for $440 million than gone and done this? Absolutely not. $300 million is a pretty big difference. But the money is bigger. The money is greener. But the grass is not always going to be. And I just wonder if this is a little bit of a... maybe an important...
Like a crossroads almost? Yeah.
An experiment for other players that say, am I sure I need to get $1 billion in 4 years? Am I sure I need to get $800 million when Soto got $765? Because what you're doing is you're putting the target on your back.
Mm-hmm.
When you break the record, now everything that you do, and this is not quarterbacking, where you can avoid throwing interceptions. Aaron Rodgers has seasons where he throws in his prime 47 touchdowns and 4 picks for 5,000 yards and wins an MVP award. That's not a game of failure. You're going to have incompletions, but it's not the same. Juan Soto is a 285 hitter. That's what he's going to hit. That's his career. That's what he should be. That's what he does. He's probably not a 40 home run guy, which he did with the Yankees last year, but let's say he's more of a 30 home run guy. He's an unbelievable offensive talent who's going to draw walks and get on base. That's his game. He's not a particularly good fielder. Like, they knew all this when they signed him.
Yep.
And I guess my point is, when you sign a deal like this in that sport, I don't think you can live up to it. There's always going to be nits to pick. There's always going to be things that are frustrating. So if you are the next guy in line, do you think about that? Does it change your conversation with your agent, Scott Boras? If you're James Wood, let's say, and when it's your turn to go get paid and you can get $800 million, do you go, am I sure I want to be a hired gun for the Mets and Steve Cohen? And the first time that I jog down the first baseline, after a single into the gap or whatever, and I don't turn it into two, Tom Easterbrook is writing the column in the New York Newsday about me.
Mm-hmm.
Am I sure I want to be the butt of everybody's conversation every single day?
Because some guys won't care. Some guys will say, "Yeah, I don't mind any of that stuff." You think of yourself as invincible, right? I mean, you got to the highest level because you are like everybody that I played with over the years that made the major leagues. Every one of them, whether everyone from Chad Tracy to Nick Swisher to Mark Teixeira to guys that I was in showcase tournaments with or summer teams with, whatever, every one of those guys knew they were a major leaguer. You know what I mean? Like, even if they weren't, I played with guys that were crazy, that thought they were but weren't. They weren't any better than me. And I'm like, dude, no, you're not. You know, there's a lot of us that are not.
Right.
But they had this no doubt situation in their brain where they would go, yeah, I'm going to the major leagues. It's not a hope. It's what's going to happen. And you don't get to the big leagues without having some kind of alpha or, athletic arrogance where you go, I don't care about that. But some people might go, Yeah, that doesn't sound like that much fun, actually. I'd like to be able to ground out a couple of times and not get booed at home. So maybe I don't want to play in Boston or New York or Philadelphia, a couple of the harsher places where they scrutinize everything. Maybe I could go to Baltimore. Maybe I could go to Minnesota or something, somewhere in between. It is something to think about that I think guys don't when they're chasing that record type stuff.
Like, I don't think Scott Boras cares.
He doesn't care
about the coverage or if there's an animus or the fact that the target's on your back because the check is cleared. And I don't mean for Boras Corp. I'm not being cynical. I mean for the player. That's his job. His job is to get that guy the most money possible. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about the dollars, as he says. It's about your value, which I agree with. And also, because he represents a lot of players and he's involved, you know, in helping the union, every time a guy gets that contract, it raises the bar forever. The market just reset itself. It's like selling a house for $200K over asking or whatever. Everyone around you in that neighborhood's going to benefit. But I just wonder if this doesn't go well. It's very early. But if this goes sideways, if there would be any kind of shift in how the next superstar player looking for the bag would think about their options. That's all. And I want to pose that question to people
combo.
At 800-636-1067. He made the choice for New York, the scrutiny, the media attention. He made the choice for the unbelievable contract that broke every record, and he did nothing wrong. I think he did everything right, in fact. But there's no way you're having as much fun as you used to when nobody was furious every time you grounded out, which is now the case because how dare you, to quote Ryan, who knows a lot about, I mean, he's a baseball guy.
Yeah.
You go, I can't pay him that much and have him hit 246, even though that's how baseball works. But that's how people think. That's literally what people are thinking about Juan Soto. Just because you paid him, now he's got to hit 300, he's got to hit 45 home runs, he can't have a bad month, he can't have a bad week. That's how you want to live for the 15 years? That's how you want to do it?
Is that what I would sign up for?
800-636-1067. Grant and Danny on the Fan. Jordan Tamu of the DC Defenders will be joining us coming up in just a few. And the general manager of the Washington Capitals, Chris Patrick, will also be on the show next hour at about 5:25. Looking forward to catching up with him, looking ahead to the offseason, the blueprint for the Caps as they try to get even further into the playoffs. Round one last year, round two this year. What will 2026 hold next spring? We'll talk to Chris Patrick about that. Danny, I will say the tweets are coming in at Grant H. Paulson, at Funny Danny. And as you'd imagine, in D.C., after Soto was traded, and remember, he didn't walk, but he didn't accept a $440 million offer by the Nationals, there's certainly no empathy for him, which is not what I'm suggesting. But what do you think? Do you think it's possible that a James Wood or that a Paul Skeens, I'm trying to think of the really young superstars,
right.
You know, Jack Centurio, who I guess has already been paid, but you know, some of these really young, great players in baseball might see what's happening with Soto and go, maybe it is, there is value in being with a fan base that loves you. Maybe there's value in avoiding that massive market and the huge contract where everything you do is under the microscope.
I think there might be some that ultimately feel that way, but I think for the most part, just these guys are wired differently than everybody else. I can't speak to obviously the mentality of every young star under 25, and frankly, I don't understand what anyone's saying that whole generation. But as you sort of go down each person, they might have an individual decision where they want to be close to home or want to be close to this coast or, you know, like where they are or have always wanted to go play somewhere else. Who knows? But in terms of the expectation, they all think that they've got to win. They got to win the next deal. They've got to be the one that sets the record. I mean, it was the whole mentality for Harper, right? It was, I got to get the most. Even though everyone knew the instant he got the most, nine people were going to surpass him in like a matter of hours. It didn't matter. He had to have the most when it was his time to sign. Kind of the same way probably with Soto, the same way with the next guy, et cetera. Every once in a while, you get Ohtani, who goes, by waving my hand next to a brand, I'll make $500 million. Or, you know, back home, countless amounts of endorsements, et cetera. I'll make all the money you'll ever imagine. I also would like to win a ton, so I'll sign this weird, funky, deferred deal. There'll be guys like that every once in a while, but for the most part, these super alphas are wired that way. I don't think they think of it. And I think they should, by the way. I think it should absolutely be a consideration where you'd go, I don't know that I'd like to be miserable. I'd like to be able to have a slump because it's the sport. It's going to happen.
The tone was set when I first saw the screaming about him drawing walks. And I was like, oh, this is going to not go as well as he wants it to this season. Because that's the game. That's what he does. That's his game. And I remember occasionally getting Nats fans would comment because he grounds out a lot. He rolls over a lot of balls to second base. When he gets on a heater, he kills the ball, lifts it, hits home runs. But he's not really a home run bat. And we've seen this with Dylan Cruz to an extent. Mm-hmm. Now, he's an extreme example because he's hitting sub 200. But I think what I've learned maybe is that there's this feeling of what a star looks like in baseball. And a star hits home runs. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
A star is a bunch of bolts and a bunch of runs batted in. Juan Soto is Ted Williams, man. Like, he's one of the greatest offensive players of all time. The numbers say that. And one of the greatest players we'll ever see. But he doesn't do it necessarily. But he's not going out and he's not going to hit 50 home runs. He's not even going to hit 330. I guess it's possible that he could. He's going to hit around 300, a little below that. But he's going to get on base a ton. That is the name of the game. You got to be on base to score runs. But when I see some of the things that they're complaining about, how does he not get to that? Because he's not a great defensive player. Like, what do you mean? This is the guy you signed. Or there was one where it was just a ball hit down to the corner, one hop the fence. And, I mean, you would have thought he just threw his glove and said, I'm not going to get it.
I won't do it.
He's not hustling, or he should have dove for that. Let's just wait for the times where you can reasonably crush him. When he hits a ball off the fence at Fenway off the Green Monster and he only gets to first, be upset he didn't try to get to second because he admired it from the box for 10 seconds. But it's not just that. I mean, they are just pouncing on this guy. I've just been stunned to see it.
Yeah, so it's pretty predictable, though, in retrospect. I probably should have seen this coming where, you know, when you sign that deal, the expectations are, well, what do you mean you didn't hit a 5-run home run every time you came up to the plate?
I think that's what it is.
You know what I mean?
That's what I didn't account for, is like this idea that when I pay you that money, .. Well, whether you're paying him $1 million or you're paying him $765 million, it doesn't change the fact that if he's going to the Hall of Fame, he's going to get out 7 times out of 10.
Yeah, I mean, we dealt with this to a certain degree here, not like with Juan Soto, but remember with Cousins, when there were contract demands, just the market value of quarterback, where it's like, we're paying all that money for what? For pretty darn good production. You know what I mean? Like, it's pretty simple, and that's what the market says. So if there's people, when huge salaries change hands in this way, people just can't come to grips with it, right? When the market says, this is what you're worth, because someone's going to pay you that, and when the money's that astounding and staggering, and it's $750 million over 15 years, and, you know, the dude in section 207 will never see that money if he had 10,000 lifetimes, right? Like, once that amount of money changes hands, everything can just get so out of whack, and people get in their emotions about it.
Huge 5 o'clock hour. Jordan Ta'amu, quarterback of the D.C. Defenders, headed to the playoffs, spent time with the Chiefs, Commanders, some other NFL stops. We'll talk to him in studio in a bit. And then Chris Patrick, GM of the Washington Capitals, going to be with us at 5:30. You're listening to Grant and Danny on the Fan.